this is Cindy S. Solomon with the Global Product Management Talk. I am delighted to welcome our speaker today, Travis Jensen, who is tweeting from @SoftwareMaven, as well as our co-host, Val Workman, who is tweeting from @ValWorkman. The Global Product Management Talk was initially conceived as a virtual forum where people who manage products situated globally could interact in real time with product management thought leaders and subject matter experts. It raises the bar for what is possible to accomplish in a real-time open platform event on Twitter. We encourage participants to expand their knowledge base with each event, utilize new products in real time. As we introduce and beta test various products participating, enable participants to showcase their knowledge and share resources and crowdsource educational content. Today, we are brought to you by the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. The AIPMM was founded in 1998 and promotes worldwide excellence in product management education while providing value to its individual members, corporate members, and sponsors through training, education, certification, and professional networking opportunities. Please visit our sponsor at AIPMM.com. Today's speaker, Travis Jensen, is a product manager and founder of ClickLock. Jensen has spent the last 15 years heavily involved in delivering software from games to websites to enterprise systems. During that time, he's worked with some amazing people, saw his share of train wrecks, and consequently had the opportunity to learn a lot. Currently, his interests revolve around how to build successful products, which starts at understanding who the customer is and ends with successful software deployment. Most people call this product management. He is the vice president of the Utah Product Management Association, the UPMA, which is an organization devoted to making both product management as a job function and product managers as job performers within the state of Utah and the surrounding area better. Yay! He uses his Software Maven blog, which you can access at softwaremaven.innerbrain.com. His Twitter handle is @SoftwareMaven.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Welcome also to our co-host, Val Workman, who recently was our showcase speaker on January 9th, where he spoke about the 7 pillars of product management and you.
Cindy, it's really great to be back.
Yes, welcome, Val. Thank you.
Today we are discussing fallacious product management. I was tweeting saying we're discussing fallacious product management, not salacious product management, if there is indeed such a thing. And if there isn't, there should be.
Could be interesting.
So Travis says that being a product manager is much like being a scientist. Scientists and philosophers have spent countless years understanding how to make rational decisions. Customer development and lean startups are all about iterative experimentation, using data to understand your customers and to shape your product. While customer development and lean methodology are discussed a lot in the startup scene, the basic tenets involving hypothesis and experimenting apply just as well to product management at companies of all sizes, because companies live or die by understanding who their customers are and building products that those customers want. Product managers must always be discovering the answers to who wants a product, why they want it, and if that desire will scale sufficiently. Invariably, product managers must orient founders that their awesome technology is not enough.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I probably don't have a whole lot to say on top of that before we dive into the actual discussion. What I would add is that as a product manager, the best thing that we can do and the thing that I think helps us the most in overcoming the trappings of that we can fall into is just humility. As we recognize that we really don't know the answers, but rather our job is to find the answers, then we can start really finding what those answers are and using good processes to find them. Again, the focus being on what makes our products work. What makes it so our customers want our products and are willing to pony up the money or the attention in order to use those products? I've spent quite a bit of time in startup environments. I've spent time in larger companies. And There are some interesting differences, but those differences tend to be more personality-oriented than they do actually process-oriented. Some other differences in there, but that's primarily it. And I think as we really focus on a scientific mindset, we can find those answers. Val, do you have anything you want to add?
I think it was very encouraging. One of the things you said is, we don't know the answers. And I think that you hit something right on the head there when you said we. So many times you hear folks talking about product management as if it was an I. I did this. I want that. I saw this. I think that. And you know what? In the product management role, nobody cares. I believe that when you got product management right, it's all about we. Product management's a team sport. A lot of the things that you're going to bring up today revolve around this notion of playing the team sport and getting rid of the I or me and focusing on the we. And then, of course, I disagree. I'm a very disagreeable person. And I disagree with the notion that the team sport is played the same at the small versus large organizations. And so maybe it's just the semantics. I'd like to hear more about your perspective there as we go into this.
I think we can come to a place where we agree because, you know, even as I was saying it, you know, there was a part of my mind saying, well, except. I guess what I would say is that the differences are at the implementation level because it kind of comes back to what you were just saying. It is about the we. The difference is that at a large company, who we is different than at a small company.
I think you got it right there. Yeah. Okay, well, then that's not so fun. I was hoping we'd have a real good discussion today. So I'm going to keep looking, but yeah, I think we're on the same page, you're right.
Yeah, please do feel free, and anybody who's following on Twitter or listening in, feel free to tell me where I'm wrong. One of the things that I'm really hoping here is to learn. I take that humility aspect seriously in that I do feel like I still have a lot to learn. As I sit down with other members of the product management community, there is almost never a meeting that goes by where I haven't learned something, where I haven't found out that I was wrong in some way or that I was less right than I could have been.
Cool.
Welcome, John Newbery. Thank you, John, for showing up no matter what time we do this. That was one of the intentions, was to make it more accessible for our colleagues in London.
Yeah.
John Newbery says that the job of product manager is not to know the answers, it's to find the answer.
And I completely agree with that. The other thing I think, one of the important roles of product management is in understanding the right questions to ask. And this is one of the things that I found in a startup a lot. I found different sides of the coin at small versus large companies. At startups, what I found is that people are so busy asking questions that it's hard to get people to focus on, you know, what the right questions are so that you're spending the resources finding the right answers. At large companies, what I found is that people tend to rely on the answers that were already there. And so they don't go out asking, are there new questions that we should be asking?
So you're saying startups, people spend resources finding answers to many questions, as opposed to in large companies, they don't have time to ask the questions.
I don't know if it's that they don't have time. It's that I think it's often that they just don't feel like they need to, that they feel like the whole row of corn has been planted and it's been seeded and the stalks are starting to grow. And so we don't need to worry, you know, we can't change direction now. There's nothing to worry about. And so the constant questioning of the marketplace, of what the customers need, of what the next new innovative thing to do is, becomes less imperative.
You know, Travis, what my experience has been is that the large companies tend to get the wrong end of the stick in the sense that more so than the small companies, large companies have the divisions of, is this product a cash cow? Is this product a dog? Is this product a rising star? And is this product a question mark? If you follow the Boston Group matrix, the notion is that if a product manager falls into a product that is categorized and expected to be a dog or a cash cow, that's the product strategy, then what you're saying, I have a feeling, will be true. But many times in large companies, I could tell you at Procter Gamble, I could tell you at GE Health, there's just many, I could just go on all day on this topic. If you end up with a product that people look at as a rising star, and the question is, how do I move it over to get to that cash cow position? Or is it the question mark where there's lots of market demand, but you really don't know how to capitalize on that yet? Wherever you are in that product, strategy is going to determine more about the kinds of questions that people ask. And the questioning, because it's a team sport, you know, when you're playing in a small team, in a small company, you may have five or six players and everybody's aware of exactly what the roles are. But when you're playing in a large team of over 100 players, sometimes you're not aware of who's doing what questions. And it's not that the questions aren't being asked, but maybe communication isn't right or something else. But I just find in general, just the opposite of what you're saying is that in a large company, you have time to ask the questions, where in small companies, you just had to make the assumption and run with it. So I'm missing something, or maybe it's just differing opinions.
So I think you are talking to certainly a level of a quadrant of experience that I don't have. And it is interesting to hear this other side of it. The larger companies that I've worked with, they did tend to maybe not explicitly group in terms of the cash cow, the rising star, and so on.
Right.
They kind of did implicitly, and that tended to definitely drive a lot of what happened behind it, even though in those situations there was potential that was lost as a result.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm trying to think. In Salt Lake, it may be basketball. I don't know. But in Texas, it's all football, right?
Mm-hmm.
And can you imagine a 9-member football team? If you're playing a 9-member football team, you've got a serious problem because halfway through the season, half your team's hurt, right?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, you just can't ask who's doing what in the roles. Everybody's doing the bare minimum, and they're executing from 6 o'clock in the morning till midnight every day. And you don't get the Sabbath off. You just keep work, work, work. As the company gets bigger, you get more people who sit on the bench, and you're able to start passing out roles and responsibilities. So finally, man, you have entire departments doing field marketing, marketing, sales marketing, pricing, and the role of the product manager gets dissected so much that it's not so much all of a sudden our biggest problem is communication. When before, in a small company, man, oh man, I didn't have to communicate, forget it. We're just, we're in automatic mode until we get this product out the door, right?
Yeah, and I would agree that the biggest problem, and it's not just a product management problem. I mean, it's the biggest problem in large organizations, period, is communication. It's an N-squared problem. It's every person you add the square of that number of communication leaks that you have to manage.
Our CEO put a blog out just recently talking about, are you the CEO of the product as a product manager? And I teased him afterwards. I said, it depends on the size of the company. In large companies, the CEO of the product really is the CEO because you have the entire company helping you on that product. Whereas when you're a small company, that's not the case. And the poor product manager feels like he's doing everything or she's doing everything by themselves. But as the company gets bigger, more and more of the company participates in product management type roles.
You know, that's an ongoing debate in the blogosphere and also the Twittersphere amongst product management. Is the product manager the CEO of the product?
Yeah.
I think we should plan a product management talk discussion on that.
We've had multiple conversations inside of the UPMA on that topic, and there isn't a solid answer.
It's strange because I think it's so clear I know exactly what the answer is, but the rest of the world doesn't agree. Yeah, you're right.
The first question that we had planned, how do you take control of product development from founders who love their product? And I really think that this is maybe it's a small company or certainly it's a startup question, because I'll tell you, when I meet startup CEOs in San Francisco at events, I'll tell them what I do as a product manager and they'll tell me that that's what they do as a CEO.
Yeah, I've seen the question of when does a startup need a product manager answered everywhere from immediately all the way up to hundreds of employees. I tend to believe it's earlier rather than later. In fact, the startup that I'm working for, founder, it's kind of a whole interesting story there, but product management was first. You know, we started the company around the notion of product management. But CEOs very often are doing product management in their companies in a startup environment. And so the real issue is that the role of product management needs to be there from day one, even if it isn't somebody with the product manager title doing it. The problem with CEOs doing product management is twofold. The first is that it's their baby that, you know, they started with this idea in the founder world. They started with this idea. They have this sort of vision in their head of what the market should want. And so you wind up with confirmation bias. You wind up with people who are going out and finding asking questions to get answers that make their idea seem correct. And that's the wrong way to do it. You want to be asking questions that are, to determine whether the product is actually viable or not. The other problem is just one of bandwidth. It doesn't take long before a CEO is worried about sales and funding and all sort of straight up, you know, human resource management, all these other things, and not focused on getting out of the building and getting answers to questions.
Right. In the background resources for this talk, you listed Steve Blank's book, Four Steps to Epiphany, and I've heard him speak on this, and that's his major point, that CEOs, at the beginning, they're out there talking to the customers, getting a sense of the market, but there reaches a point where they shouldn't be out there anymore. They need the product manager to be out there. But at the beginning, when you're constantly iterating, it does take the CEO having a direct experience of what the feedback is.
And so really, it's just you need to have somebody doing that product management who is also making sure that product is getting built. And that most often in early startups is a founder.
The real question here isn't so much a who should be doing what. I think you're throwing out here is that there's a time when the function of a product manager maybe have to migrate from the CEO to somebody else. And with that, typically the authority doesn't go with them.
Right.
And so the real problem is more about responsibility being aligned with the right authority. Is that correct?
Yeah, there does come a point where, okay, the company has grown. The CEO now recognizes I'm too busy to actually get out of the office and talk to the customers and understand my market. And so they bring in the product manager, who is now supposed to take over. And now you're dealing with multiple issues. You've got a CEO who doesn't really want to give up the product, but recognizes that they have to. You have employees who have gone to the CEO as the source of information, you know, who if generally will believe that that CEO actually really does understand what's going on in the market. You've got investors who are looking to the CEO for this product guidance all the way along, that now you have to worry about ensuring they catch your vision. And so there's a lot of pieces in there that you now have to realign and sort of restructure the company and the communication channels in the company to make that happen.
That's a real good insight. One of the things that we have done in the past when we see as a consultant, we see this so many times, Travis, you're right. This is a major problem that folks have to go through and experience. But what one of the processes or mechanisms that we use as a medicine for this is a gated process where product management, the CEO is reluctant to just throw that over the fence. Okay, now I'm going to hire a product manager and they're going to take care and the success and failure of my company is going to depend on this other person. It's not going to happen. So, so what we do is we find very small increments of authority and responsibility. So the CEO still holds a major portion of the authority and decision-making on the product. And there are small, short increments where the CEO sits and reviews decisions that the product manager and product management team make, and they don't allow it to go forward until the CEO gives its blessings. And that does two things. Yeah, the CEO feels like they have authority, but how long do you think that lasts before the CEO becomes primary bottleneck?
So one of the things that I wanted to mention in terms of this question is that as a product manager, there are CEOs that I wouldn't take a job with. There are CEOs who won't give up the reins. And actually, I think that would be a really interesting discussion. How do you identify those CEOs?
Exactly. I was just going to say, hey, I want 1A to B. How do I identify the attributes of those guys to avoid?
Because yeah,
there's so much heartache goes into picking the wrong CEO. You got that one dead on.
Steve Blank talks about CEOs come from chaotic families of origin.
Yeah, I've seen that. And so does that mean that you're entering a dysfunctional family?
Totally.
And you become a product manager there?
Totally. That's part of the – that might be the source of the problem.
But one of the things that I try to do to gauge that sort of CEO-level willingness is a humility check. You know, if I go in and I'm talking to the CEO and he or she is just, I know this. I know where the world needs to be. This is where we're going. Nothing can stop us. That throws up big warning flags to me. If I go in and I'm talking with a CEO who is like, this is what we found so far and this is what we're trying to do to keep finding out more information, then I'm more comfortable, right? Because what I want to know is, of course, I don't expect to go into a startup and say, okay, I'm the product manager now. everybody pay attention to me. It's going to take time for me to come up to speed on the product, on the market, on all of the issues that are involved there, all of the decisions that have been made that we don't want to have to go through and try to relearn. And that transition period can either be greatly helped or greatly hindered. And what happens is if the CEO isn't willing to relinquish those reins, then you become a waiter, right? You're the guy that's taking the orders from the CEO and then going to the, you know, the cooks on the development team and the product development side and saying, okay, build this. And that's not where I want to be, because that's not where I feel like I can add value to the company.
Exactly. So I just want to add in that John Newbery had said that founders can be great allies or a real problem, or both at the same time, and agrees strong communication helps. And it's important to share founders' passion and show you can build on their vision.
Yeah, I think that is so completely true and so important. Let's say I'm going into a market, a startup in a market that I have 20 years of experience in, and you know, I've spent the last 20 years deep inside of the customer's minds in that market. Until I have the trust of the CEO, he's not going to give anything to me. So I have to take all of that knowledge and really finesse the conversations with the CEO to be able to take his ideas and take his passions and both be able to apply that experience as well as take and learn from his experience or her experience. So that, I mean, the whole reason why the startup is existing is because somebody found some blue sky that they could go inside of the other giants in the area. And the implication there is there's something for me to learn in the process. And if the CEO doesn't feel like I'm willing to learn that, he's never going to give up the reins.
Exactly. And it's surprising that you could have gotten hired by the CEO. But I guess that they will hire product managers because they think it's a great idea, not having any idea what's involved.
Well, and there are also cases where they get pushed to do so by their board.
Yeah.
And it's like everything else. You know, dating members of the opposite sex can be a dangerous thing, right? Everybody tells everybody what they want to hear. I wanted to get back to John's comment, though, is one of the things that I was always taught and I found very effective is to get a roadmap out and then engage my stakeholders. And it's not until I have a roadmap and I'm able to engage my stakeholders that I get true buy-in and I get that transition of authority. I found that the roadmap has been the key for me to wrestle some of that authority away from the CEO. If they see the roadmap and see the direction I'm going, and that they've had input into that direction, so they feel like it's their roadmap, and then I engage them and show them how they can participate into the ensuring the success of that roadmap, that's when what John, you know, maybe in a different mechanism, but the things John's talking about, and when he's talking about engaging our executives, if we can find ways, and I found the roadmap to be a very good tool for this, to engage them at the proper levels, then you get a win. And all of a sudden, all your stakeholders let go of the reins a little bit more for you.
Yeah, I think that's a great comment and couldn't agree more.
Excellent. Our second question was, what is the difference between product management at a small company and at a large company? We have spoken to that. Is there anything else we wanted to say about that?
Yeah, one thing I think that I would add, and maybe it is, so I guess maybe in some ways it is kind of reversing what I said earlier, but one of the big differences, so in the end, it's all communication, but for me, the horizon is very different in a small company versus a large company. In a small company, my time horizon on things that I care about is really fairly short. I'm looking 6 months is forever where I'm at right now. I mean, we don't even think about anything past 6 months. And obviously, large company, that horizon is much larger. 5-year strategy, 3-year roadmap. And that does impact sort of the day-to-days a lot, which fortunately there are generally more people to help fill in the difference in distance there.
It's easy to point at differences. What you said earlier, I'm thinking about it also, Travis, and there are many similarities. And if I changed a few small words, the product management functions, what needs to get done in product management doesn't change. It doesn't matter what industry, doesn't matter what your skill sets are, doesn't matter what your product line is, doesn't matter the size of the company. The functions of product management stay the same, and you just end up doing without some. If you're a small company, you don't get some of the robustness that you get in some of the larger companies. What you said, I just really loved, you have to pick and choose. It's like a portfolio of things that you can focus on, the questions that you need to have answered. You just have to ignore some of them. And it's the same thing in product management functions. you just ignore some of them and move forward. If you're talking about the functions of product management, I couldn't agree more, is they're the same. But dadgummit, it's who's doing them and how much makes the big question.
Yeah, so the theoretically, they're the same, but, you know, in reality, there's a lot of difference.
Yeah.
So the Q3 was small companies are notoriously technology driven. Assuming we're talking about software companies, how do you encourage product results instead? Someone who's not a tech person recently told me that everything is software. Going forward, the prognosis is that everything, every new product is software oriented.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think even outside of software, I think this question is applicable, though, you know, even at the level of building a car, right, you still need to, you can focus on, so building an electric car, you can focus on, oh, let's just make the battery something special, or you can focus on making a car that people want to drive, which implies a lot of trade-off. Though I will specifically say that I do speak mostly predominantly from a software background, and so my question will probably be focused a little bit on in that area. What I see, one of my big goals as a product manager, this isn't just at small companies, one of my big goals is to help other people in the organization empathize with the customer. What I found is that almost everybody that I've ever worked with wants to do the right thing. They want to make a product that they are proud of, that people like, that people want to use. But oftentimes, they don't have enough information to be able to make decisions that on their own will accomplish that. So if I can take the information that I have and put it into a form that helps other people in the organization to empathize with the customer, then I don't have to be the one making every decision. And the creativity that other people have inside of the organization can be focused in the right direction. And one of the things about design is you can't have good design without constraints. And so I see myself trying to put those constraints in place so that when an engineer sits down to build something, they understand what the box is that they can build in, and then they can fit the pieces in the box the best they can. When a user experience person that I'm working with is sitting down, you know, if I can get them the constraints, they can do better things inside of it.
Val saw that John Newbery had asked a side question. Is it possible or common for product managers to transition from large companies to small companies? Is it successful or high risk? Is that the question that you were responding to, Val?
It is, if I could take just a second. John, it's a great question. And what we found in the industry, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking software, hardware, food manufacturing, small company, if a product manager starts out in a small arena or a large arena, and they stay in that arena for more than 3 years, they become extremely biased and their mental map changes. In the large company, they keep thinking of we. They keep thinking of all the things that need to be done, and they're able to manage those resources, collect that information, and act as a we. And that's great in that environment. But on the same token, let's flip that around. Take that we person and put them in a small startup where they don't have all those resources to lean on. And more than not, it's an I. It's my responsibility as a product manager to do all these things. And as Travis was talking about balancing those questions, these people who have been in the we environment for so long, they have an extremely difficult time to do anything, and they end up paralyzed because they can't go forward. They're not used to making decisions without all the information. And in this environment of uncertainty, they don't deal very well in. And just the opposite of that, if I take a startup product manager who's been in that industry or space for 3 years or more, it's extremely hard to get them to quit doing everything themselves and to start trusting in others. And you just can't wrestle that away. And so one of the things that I always look for in resumes, if they've been a product manager for more than 3 years in one of those things, that's where they're stuck. I don't hire them. You've got to mix it up, or else you're going to be very, you know, you have to seriously demonstrate a ability to change your thinking in terms of we and me. And the same pattern happens when you talk about a sales guy going from a product sales to a solution sell to a consultative sell. 89% fail to transition. The same thing with product managers.
I agree with that. And I think it's actually easier to transition from large to small than from small to large. I don't know that it's impossible, but you do have to work hard, right? You really do have to show that if you're going from large to small, that you understand what the different issues are, and that you have strategies that you can show to deal with that. And really, it's going to be hard to go out and put in a resume in front of somebody to make that happen. But it's the sort of thing that if I were hiring another product manager, and I had a relationship with somebody who was a product manager at a large company, and after several months of us talking, and he could show me that he's put forth the effort to understand that difference and to figure out how to deal with it, there wouldn't be a problem hiring them. But it is going to be hard to get in on a resume.
You know what's funny? I'm going to start referring to this as the Travis Law. I think that if they're ideal and if they were playing their roles ideally, so these product managers, small or large companies, knew what their role was and was doing the function the correct way. In either case, they'd be able to transition to the next organization or the next industry with no problems, right? Because they're doing the function that one small component of product management, they're doing that correctly. But what happens is that's like the ideal gas law, right? It's all vapor. It's hard to find people who are doing that function correctly because they have to compensate in either a large or small organization. And that's where it starts breaking down. But if they were following the Travis law, I'm beginning to think that they should be able to transition to across industries and across corporate size without a problem.
And I think that's true. But it is hard to find people who who are focused on the product management and not on whatever the current process is in their company.
Yeah, I think it's like the noble gas laws. I don't think they exist.
Well, there's a few of them. I mean, there's 100 and some odd elements, and there's 8 noble gases, right?
There you go, yeah. How fun. I tend to agree. Wow, that's an interesting question, John. I appreciate it.
We had a couple of people come into the room. I believe it's Nick Coster from Sydney, Australia, with BrainMate. Usually my co-host, but also welcome Marlene and Brian to reiterate what the new Travis Law that you just coined is. I wanted to get the... It's a summary of that.
I should probably think of a better way of stating it. Excuse me. The gist of it stems from the notion of it shouldn't matter whether it's a large or small company. And I'm going to extend that. And it shouldn't matter what industry you're in. It shouldn't matter what product you're doing. Product management is a practice. And each function of that practice should be the same regardless of where you are. And you do that, like if you're trying to do a customer visit, you do a customer visit the same whether you're a large or small company. There are good practices that surround the customer visit. Are you doing a win-loss report? Well, there are specific practices, and it doesn't matter who or where you're coming from. You should do win-loss that way. And so that's the ideal or noble gas. It's the function that's ideal. In reality, though, we tend not to do functions that way. We tend to string them all together, push them all together, pack it up, and in the name of efficiency, blend things together. So pretty soon, it makes a huge difference as far as who you are, where you're coming from, which company you're working for, which product you're working for, because we've polluted the best practice. And I think that's what I was trying to get at.
There may be another aspect of that, which also has to do with just the overall size of the task at hand, kind of like a lawyer, right? I mean, there are lawyerly best practices, but you still have specialization inside of the law because the breadth is just too large for any one person. I'm not sure how that plays into it. I think it might, but I haven't thought enough about it to be able to understand that.
Okay. Another topic for more discussion. So Q4, pointing us back to startups, the question
is... You're pushing it a little bit there, Cindy. It's only February. You're already in Q4?
Well, on the roadmap.
My heart's palpitating. I go, oh, no.
So our question 4 was, how do you accomplish product management on a shoestring budget? And I'm assuming you're referencing lean startup environments.
Yeah, but I think that really what we're talking about here is, how do you get the maximum amount of information for the minimum number of dollars in a startup environment? Well, that happens just because there aren't enough dollars. So if you don't focus on that, you're not going to get any information. But I think even in larger companies, the same concepts apply. The more information you can get for every dollar of investigatory money spent, the better data you have to make decisions. You know, this is one that I continue to struggle with. I don't know that I have the perfect answer for this question. And it really does depend on, I mean, there are a lot of depends, just like any kind of customer feedback, there are a lot of depends in there. But in general, the way that I try to approach this problem is by looking at who my market is, finding the best way to touch the most of them. Right now, FlickLock is focused in the middle of our experiment on whether to focus consumer or whether to focus enterprise on some aspects of our product. In this regard, we accomplish that a couple of ways. One is on the consumer side, I'm a big fan of surveys just because you can get a lot out there. You have to be careful that you're getting decent information, that you're asking good questions, but you can relatively inexpensively on consumer products get some decent information. On the enterprise side, getting quantitative information is really hard. And I will say that this part is very much startup focused. Getting quantitative information is hard and can be very expensive. So I've tended to focus more on qualitative information. And one of my favorite ways of doing that is through trade conferences and just stopping everybody that I walk by. People are amazingly ready to give information to help people who are trying to start new companies. And you can get a lot of really great information very quickly that way.
I like where you're going with that, Travis. I was trying to look some things up while you were talking, and I went back to January 2009 to remind those who don't remember, over 70% of product managers were out of work. There were huge layoffs, and it was a very hard time in the United States when we talk about these things. At that moment, I think that we would define that as when times are hard, our budgets are on a shoestring. And I found it very interesting. Out of 1,200 companies that were surveyed in January of 2009, social media spending had an average of 65% increase in budget spending. They increased their social media spending 65% in a time when dollars were extremely rare. And out of that, Twitter played a role of 92% of those strategic plans and a key role in 76% of the social media campaigns going forward. And so when you start talking about how do you do product management, clearly the industries across the United States felt that social media was going to play a bigger role in product management, in market sensing and promotion than they ever had before. And to this day, now 2012, those numbers have done nothing but increased. And so I think that's not only a validation, but also it helps shine the flashlight on where tomorrow's product managers need to look. And then I would add a couple of things because I get the impression, Travis, I'm just a little bit older than you are. I don't know how old you are, but old people sense other old people. And so I just got to tell you, one of the things that it is do product management right. I don't care how much it costs. You know, when they come in, they'll say, cut your budget, cut this, cut that. You have to realize this, whether you're building a piece of furniture, building a house, an automobile, do it right. It always costs more money to do it wrong than to do it right the first time. Don't take any shortcuts. If you want to do product management, if you're being held accountable for product management and they say we need to do this as economically as possible, change that and do it as effectively as possible.
When we talk about what it takes to transition between large and small, I think that's one of the areas that is challenging. I mean, my first stint in product management was in a fairly large organization, and you actually had budget to do things. And so that's been one of the big learning things for me is how to be effective while not needing to spend that much money. And effective, I mean, what effective means differs between, you know, a brand new product and a $100 million product.
Really good point.
Nick Koster, bring me to trying to get a word in edgewise. So he had said back to our question 4 before we got off on a tangent regarding how do you accomplish product management on a shoestring budget. He said that this speaks to the separation of product management as a domain versus industry knowledge. Both are important. And I guess that was talking about the Travis Law.
Yes, that's correct.
To question 4, he said, start with one customer. Speak to them. If you don't speak with at least one, then it gets very expensive later. Also, John Newbery said, in the absence of pound notes or dollars, passion can be a good currency to buy support and creates networks. Nick also said you can almost always find one person within driving distance. And John Newberry says get solid key performance indicators in place and measure frequently. Solve issues. Get back and track quickly to minimize the impact of costs. Nick also says that social media and online services can provide a massive amplification effect for messages worth sharing cheaply.
And I would agree with that. I mean, you haven't touched at all on the whole marketing side of startups, which makes sense in this particular thing.
Right.
But social media, there's no question that's a huge, huge component going forward for all product managers. And to ignore that is really going to be at your product's peril. And there are companies that are doing really neat things with being able to do product sensing, sentiment sensing through social networks and allow you to tap into that whole feed of information and use that to make quantitative decisions.
That's the reason we're doing this, why it's important to have product managers use all avenues.
I'd like to go back to what Travis had said right at the beginning when we were talking about the questions and being able to pick the right questions. Is when you start talking about doing product management on a shoestring, I think that skill comes into play. And what I found to work, the theory of constraints, but if you think about product management as an opportunity pipeline and you have opportunities to impact your product and the return on your product's investment, then you can take a look and say, okay, there are three major divisions that Harvard Business School proposed a few years ago. One of them is idea generation, and then you think about conversion of ideas into product concepts, and then finally getting those product concepts out into the internal, if you're in a large company, getting buy-in and everybody working together on the team, and even externally as you're talking about channel partners and the marketplace in general. And so whether you talk about diffusion, conversion, or idea generation, look at if you're on a shoestring budget, don't go out and try to fix everything. You know, I said do PM right. So what I meant by that is look and find out where your constraint is. Many small companies don't get enough ideas or inputs from the customer base, but larger companies get 10,000 ideas a month. They have way too many from the process. Travis had said, it's all about our scope here. Look at your ideas and say, is this a constraint? Is this causing me problems? And focus on that. If that's not a constraint, then go downstream and say, okay, well, what about idea conversion? We're having a problem converting product concepts into products. Well, then focus on that. And so by looking at the constraints, those things that are holding back the flow of your opportunity pipeline, focus on that and only improve it to the next level. So you'd only improve, let's say I have a conversion problem and I improve it by 2%. I don't go any further than that and get it down to perfection because I know that my idea conversions are my new constraint as soon as I lower. And so it's a matter of keeping everything in balance and picking those fights properly. Is that kind of what you were talking about at the beginning? Is that true, Travis?
Yeah, I think a great summary. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself.
I think that'll help us on that shoestring problem.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. It's easy to optimize for a problem that's not the blocking problem, especially since many of the product managers I know, they're a lot like me. They're perfectionists, right? We want things perfect.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So, and perfection is the enemy of good enough. And, you know,
or especially the least viable product, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that minimum viable product is all about good enough.
I love it. I haven't heard about that before. That's right. You got it, man.
So BrainMates said when you have too many ideas to start with, pick one and test it. You will never know if it was the best one, then do it again, which totally summarizes and goes right back to where you opened with experimentation and hypothesis.
Right.
Yeah. And I think you don't need to know the best one. You just need to know one that works. If you keep trying to find the best one, you're going to be wasting time that you could have been spent getting the one that works to work.
Great. John Newberry says, worked for me. This one is going up on the office wall. Perfection is the enemy of good enough. Excellent. So, Travis, I think we got a few software maven-isms today.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see where the Travis law shows up.
Great. So thank you, Marlene Bryan. Thank you, John Newberry, Nick Koster, Software Maven, Val Workman. And today's stats were 117 tweets generated 178,734 impressions. We reached an audience of 20,000 plus followers. I want to thank our speaker, Travis Jensen, as well as our co-host, Val Workman. I invite you to come back. Certainly, this was just the tip of the iceberg, and the Global Product Management Talk is employing all different types of media to continue the conversations between product managers. So thank you so much for your audio time.
I've been looking for the way folks do things in Salt Lake versus Texas. And, you know, we don't have shoestring budgets. We have barbed wire budgets, just so you knew that.
Sounds more painful.
just wanted to know. I've been trying to figure out now, what is a shoestring budget? But I think I've got it.
That's an interesting. On a tight budget. There we go.
We're on a tight budget of time. Join me again. The podcast will be available on iTunes, as well as on the Android mobile application, so you can stream it directly to your Android, coming soon to the iPhone.
Cindy, thanks a whole lot for helping us today.
Yeah, Cindy, thank you. And Val, thank you very much. Your input has been great. I learned a lot.
Well, I appreciate both you guys and look forward to talking with you some more, Travis. Thank you.
Thank you.